Accession number 30260, Reel 4.
And it was the Americans that really and truly saved us. To their Marines, very well trained and not afraid to lose hundreds and thousands of people, but get in and fight. The Australian soldier was very, very good, but the leaders were shocking. There was no leadership, in my opinion.
In relation to your sort of learning on the job, this sort of training experience, going, okay, stay away from us for, you know, 3 nights.
Yes.
When you did that the first time, how did you find that as an experience?
Frustrating, very frustrating. You know, you did that and you wondered, how good is it? What is it doing to us? You know, couldn't we get some better information? Heavy back sack we had where we carried all our things in. Far too heavy. How are you going to go there in enemy territory with that, you know? Surely we could have got better ways of doing. For example, I said to the doctor, I feel that when we go, what about medicine? He said, well, what about medicine? I said, well, don't you think if we're on a trip, we can't go to see a Japanese doctor, we can't do anything. So shouldn't we at least have enough malaria tablets? Because my father was a doctor, you see. Malaria tablets so that we can take malaria, so we won't get malaria, because if we're up there and get malaria, what's going to happen? Oh, well, that's nothing to do with me. I've never been told about it, so if you want it, I can get you some malaria tablet. But again, you felt immediately, well, there was no thought put onto this. Dysentery. If you get, especially Basilea dysentery, you're gone. You know, you absolutely can't move. How do you prevent it? Well, you mustn't drink their water, you mustn't eat their food. You must only eat boiled food that you boil yourself and eat, and certainly boil the water for quite a long time and drink that. Although in the tropics hot, to drink hot water is not pleasant, but that's better than dying. But nobody was ever instructed on this. Never was told about this. I made this all up.
Well, here you are. I mean, you mentioned, you know, your father was a doctor. You yes. lived in these places. You knew what it was like.
Yes.
Were you able to impart your advice to people? Would they listen?
They didn't listen. They were not. They just didn't want to listen. The concept there was, don't move. Don't get things going.
Don't rock the boat.
Don't rock the boat. Exactly. You know, that's not my job. You know, you see, I suggested, and I always did, I didn't take all these bully beef and all that stuff. All I took was a little bag of rice, salt, and that was all I took, and a billy. Now, when I was in there, I would take that water that I had, boiled it, and boil it with the rice, and that's what I lived on, just plain boiled rice and salt. The salt to replace the salt I lost to the heavy perspiration, and the salt and the rice to keep me going nourished. And I found that kept me very nourished. And if I could, passing a little villages and I saw chooks and I was able to get an egg, well, I would boil that egg and eat that with it. But that was very seldom that you'd be lucky enough to have that, because you didn't want to go against the native Sada, so you didn't want to kill any of the chooks or something, so you didn't. So I myself made that up, and that's how I survived in many cases. Many, many people that were lost were because of illness, far more than were caught by the Japanese, because they were never told these things. And I always took, in those days we still had the old-fashioned tablet for malaria. I took that every day, every moment. The Australian troops and the Australian, oh, we're tough. We didn't do that in Australia. We never used this. I've been, and they didn't realize the difference. You see, and the same thing again with the water. Beautiful water coming down, you know, from a small sort of falls. But you couldn't drink it because they used it for their toilets. They used. So boil it. And that saved me from getting these diseases. And I always wore long clothes for mosquitoes. Not sure, although it's very uncomfortable because it's very hot, you know, where the Australians were inclined to take off their shirt and walk without a shirt on. And so. But in the jungle you have mozzies day and night, you see, there. And things like that. It was my personal observations and what my parents had told me, my father, that I felt that I survived from those things. Because there was no training, there was no idea on that. Now, funny part, the SAS, I was talking to the doctor, they pump you full with antibiotics before you go in, so you don't get these diseases. But not in those days.
Obviously, this is, you know, you hear of people living off the land and, you know, sort of using their resources. Prior to you actually going in and experiencing it, I mean, obviously you had some kind of knowledge, but prior to this, was this something that you were formulating before you'd gone? Before you actually set off?
Well, before we go off, I realized we were going to go into the jungle because we couldn't be seen in daytime, so we had to make a camp or something, what we trained for in Cairns, in the jungle. Now I said, to survive in a jungle in Indonesia or in Malaysia, what do I need? And then I made up my own mind. I need malaria tablets. I'm going to get them by hook or by crook. Enough for the whole time that I'm going to be there. I don't want to carry all this heavy stuff. And I certainly didn't want to, what I gave as a rifle. What am I going to do with a rifle in an enemy country with hundreds and thousands of troops? And here I am at 5 or 10 bullets. So I don't want to carry a rifle. I'll carry at the most a Western revolver with 6 bullets, and I take 6 more just in case something can happen. More for psychological reasons, because I don't think it'd be any better. A very good knife, I think you needed that, that is very sharp, and that can also, big enough, actually more like a sword, that can cut a bit for the jungle to get through. That's the thing you need. And then, as I say, I took rice, because okay, and all that other stuff I left home. A compass I took, but was useless. You work a compass in thick jungle at night time, you got no chance. No, you just go the path, and you go in the approximate direction. That's how you can do that. But even a compass, it was really useless. But it was a good compass. I took it. I always say I lost it. And then you could sell them and get a good price for it. But don't say that.
But here, I mean, you get this sort of image of, oh, you know, sort of people learning all this knife, you know, how to kill someone with twist of the wrist and all that sort of thing.
Never come to it. That's not what you do. Although I must admit, and I can't discuss that, it has come. I have had 2 missions in there. I was an assassinator. And that still worries me now. And that was very close counter in which I had to assassinate. And it was nearly in the end, or more in the in a very important, there was a man from the Japanese Gestapo type of person who was very, very intelligent and got very close to some small resistant movements we had. And he was clever, and they were getting very close to destroying that. And I was sent to get rid of him. And the only way was to assassinate him. And with it brought some other complex that I don't want to discuss about.
Well, here's the other thing. You're still officially under the Secrecy Act.
Yeah.
So there will obviously be things that we are not allowed to talk about.
Yes.
But in relation to then, what do you recall? Were you, you know, to what degree was the level of secrecy, as it were, when you were on these missions, when you were being
prepared? Well, it was very, very strongly stressed to us and told, you're not to talk. No, that's not for me. My wife will take that. One thing that I've always been thinking about, even long after the war, even now, is could I have refused some of those missions or orders that I received? And I've never been able to answer that to myself. What would have happened if I had said, I'm not doing this anymore? I was under the impression then that I couldn't. You're in it, and now you're in it for good. But I don't know. But I know that I have always been strictly told it's all very secret, and they gave us some very nasty stories of people that had broken that. What they did, they said, was declared you mentally ill, and you went into an asylum.
This is what you were being told at the time?
Yeah. And there you'll be for the rest of your life, not fit enough to get out. Now, is it true? Were they going to do that? Or was it just to scare us? I don't know, but that certainly scared me. Very bewildered I was. Confused and bewildered. And even now, today, because of this secrecy, my wife thinks I'm mad sometimes. She doesn't believe it. She doesn't believe me. What is the greatest security they have? Nobody believes you. If you tell these stories, the real story, they wouldn't believe you. There's only one person that I know that believed me, and that was the commanding officer of the SAS, because he knew me, and he knew from files that nobody else saw what was going on, so he knew. But nobody else does. My wife, my children, I dare not talk. They think I'm mad. They don't believe me. And the funny part is, some people thought, well, it's weird. And they tried to find a lot out of me. And they got in touch with the Australian forces, give us all the details of Baines. And all they got back, no information on him. We know nothing about him, never heard of him. So then they heard that I was on Dutch sub, so they went to the Dutch Navy, and they said, well, there was this Dutchman that was for 2 years on various Dutch subs. What you tell us about it? And the response was, no availability to the public on this matter. No availability on this matter. So I can't even prove what, in a way, is going against me, because I got the gold card and all the benefits, but if I could prove that through these jungle and so I got my asthma, I could get not so much a pension, but if I die, my wife would get the gold card too. But I can't prove it, because if I go in, there's no record of you. And I go to the Dutch and I say, well, because we have no record that you were on the sub. We know nothing about you. So it's even, it has definitely stopped me from getting things.
Well, I mean, you have these awards. You have, you know, the service award.
Yeah.
And
they'll give you that.
And there's proof that you were involved.
Yeah, but
no, they're on the mantelpiece.
Yeah, but when you get to the nitty gritty and say, well, oh no, we've got nothing on you. You see, there was a letter published in 1952 or something, 54. No, in 78 or 87 of the big Dutch newspaper, the Telegraaf. You might have heard of it. It's called the Telegraaf. It's the biggest Dutch newspaper in Holland. And it said, names of people that served in Z-Force. You know? And here's the first name being B, Mr., no rank, Mr. E.M. Baines. And I got to please explain. Have you been talking to the Telegraph? I said, I know nothing about it. Well, how did he get your name? I said, well, don't ask me. You know, and there was a quite a few times that I was, you know, looked down and said, better not come from you. Then all of a sudden I've never heard any more about it. But I got so curious that I got that paper, and I've still got the paper here, with the name, and he is me, Mr. E. How they got it, what they got it. But I was blamed for it. Funny business.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you were interrogated at one point about, you know, your comments
regard
Japanese and the intentions of...
That's right. You know, that didn't encourage that at all. And I still feel that still goes for today. You know, it's a little bit more relaxed, but I feel I've got to be very careful what I say. And they very quickly be able to make you look like a fool, because you got no information, you got no proof of anything. You know, you get things. For example, when I applied for my gold card, they say, come back in 3 days, give me your records. Okay, we don't find these records. There's none of this true. You know, and the girl practically told, it was a lady, you know, you're making this up. I said, no. She said, you were never in these forces or in any forces. I said, no, don't be ridiculous. Well, she said, there's no record. And I thought, well, what the heck am I going to do? So I got in touch with my mate, the commanding officer on the SAS. He got in touch with what is now ASIO. In my days, there wasn't ASIO. It was called the committee. And on the committee were... it's now he got in touch with them. And next thing, all of a sudden, I got a letter. You have been given the gold card, and here's your gold card. But no records.
In relation to the way I found you was that you were actually in an article which was written up in the local rag,
yes,
saying that you were in Z Force.
Yeah.
Now, one of the first things that we mentioned when I rang you, I mean, you're in the phone book.
Yeah.
One of the things that I we mentioned was that you were not going to be able to tell us, you know, specific details, and you know, obviously I want to respect that. In relation to sort of preparations to go away, though, you mentioned you weren't given much information. Now, presumably you were sort of told at the very last minute, okay, we're going to drop you here, and that,
yes,
this is what you've
right.
got to do. Can you tell us the experience, even if you can't tell us the place and what you're actually there for, can you tell us the experience of preparing to go away for your first operation?
Well, the first operation preparing was sort of a testing, I felt. We went through that same exercise in the camp, and there were three of us. There was an Australian captain, and Pommy, lieutenant, myself, and a native. The native from that area where we were going to land. Our principal there was to land there, and there was a small group of people that wanted to start a resistance against the Japs on that island, and wanted us to help. And we had to assess if it was genuine, was it set up by the Japs, or was it a genuine thing? And if so, what do they want it, and how were we going to get it to them? You know, by the submarine landing and things like that. So that was the first. And we were told that the day before we went. So up we went, we got onto the sub, we went down, we landed, and they were there.
Well, what was the experience like of, I mean, going on a submarine?
Very, very that was the first time I was on a sub, and I thought, very exciting. Especially when they said, now, when you hear three bells, or toot, 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 that means we're going to dive. You know, and I expected something like a plane shot, but you don't notice it. You hear CC, you have a bit of a funny feeling in your ear, pressure difference, and then I said, when are we going to die? He said, we're already underwater. You know, didn't even know. I said, oh, it's not that exciting. And come up again, you know. So that was the first thing. It was all exciting. When we actually got to the place, it was dark and very... They said, you can come on the bridge now. That's where you got to supposed to land there. And you're going to land by having to swim down we'll try to get you as close as possible, depends on the depth of the water, and then you just get out and swim up to the beach, and when we wore native clothes, and they'll tell you what the position is there. And we were scared stiff because we thought if they're from the Japs, all that. And they kept on saying, I hope you have your tablet in your mouth to swallow if the if it turns out to be the Japs. Yeah, now don't forget your tablets, they kept on saying that. And being the first time, oh, talking like that, I was scared stiff, I'd bite all that. And that was arsenic, you see. But later on you realize that you could swallow them and nothing would happen. You have to actually break it by the... But, you know, first time that... Oh, well, you know...
Well, I mean, here we are.
Scared
Steve. Issued with something that's going to finish you instantly, yeah. if it gets to that. I mean, how does someone say, look here, mate, you better take one of these just in case?
Yeah, they look at you if it's very normal. If you say, have a chocolate or something, you know. But you feel terrible, you know. And inside, you can't describe it, you know. You feel scared. You feel everything from, God, how the hell am I getting in this situation? But you look at the other two and you say, well, we all have to do it. Now they look at you, so off you go, you know. And it turned out that they were very loyal people, actually. There was one island, there were mainly Christians, and they were very loyal. So they helped us.